Ukraine. He spoke with me earlier from Washington. The dismal science, as economists often call it, is hardly dismal when illustrated in drama, fiction, and poetry. That's what Purdue University economics professor Michael Watts has just reviewed in his own new book, The Literary Book of Economics. In 78 excerpts of literature, fiery, humorous, and wild, Watts finds a world of economics written in the drama of ordinary and extraordinary life. Would you rather learn economics from Milton Friedman or Upton Sinclair? So what comes first, the economics or the human condition or the literature of the human condition? And did your summer reading make you an economic genius, even if by accident? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Michael Watts joins us tonight from Hanover, Germany. Good evening and welcome, economist and a close observer now of literature, Michael Watts.
Thanks, Tom. I'm happy to be here.
It's great to have you. Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello there, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello, Professor Watts.
Hi, Jack.
Michael Watts, you're an economist through and through, but you've clearly really got the literary bug tonight. We want to jump right in to some of the many readings that we're going to have tonight and get your reading of it with one that everybody will get right away, and then we'll hear from you how you came around to this kind of approach to economics. But let's hear, and we've had friends put these recordings together for us today, let's hear Robert Frost's The Road Not Taken, thinking all the while about one of those great economic principles, opportunity cost.
Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both and be one traveler. Long I stood and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth. Then took the other as just as fair, and having perhaps the better claim, because it was grassy and wanted wear. Though as for that, the passing there had warned them really about the same, and both that morning equally lay in leaves no step had trodden black. Oh, I kept the first for another day, yet knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh somewhere, ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference.
Robert Frost, The Road Not Taken, and Michael Watts, we've all read that and leaned back and gotten dreamy and sort of imagined what that means, maybe even taken it into our own lives. But you, the economist, look at it and you see economic principles there in Frost's lines. Take us in from that point of analysis.
Well, it's a very simple point. Economics is all about the fact that you can't have everything you want, but you can have some of the things you want. But when you do that, you give up the chance to use the time and resources and money to do other things that you would also like to do if you could, if there weren't scarce resources. But as it turns out here, it's a very straightforward idea. He had to make a choice. He chose one choice. Most people were making another choice. And so the line that everybody remembers from Frost, I took the one last travel by, and that has made all the difference. The point in the poem that I think is really interesting that another economist actually pointed out to me when I was teaching one of his classes for him, is the earlier line that says that those for the passing there had warned them really about the same.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an equilibrating idea that comes up in economics very often, that the returns adjusted for risk tend to balance out over time or in equilibrium.
Do you think Robert Frost was thinking as an economist as he sat down to write this, or is it just that human beings are fundamentally economic in the way they perceive, even if they're great writers?
Well, the first book I ever learned to read, my first favorite book, my mother says, was a little kid's book that went, Bobby had a nickel, all his very own, should he buy some candy or an ice cream cone? Same idea. And
there you had it in doggerel. I want to keep plunging right ahead. We're going to hear more, but let's hear from Charles Dickens right now from Hard Times, 1854, satire on industrialism. Here we have a factory town described. Let's listen for the economics.
It was a town of red brick, or a brick that would have been red if the smoke and ashes had allowed it. But as matters stood, it was a town of unnatural red and black, like the painted face of a savage. It was a town of machinery and tall chimneys, out of which interminable serpents of smoke trailed themselves for ever and ever, and never got uncoiled. It had a black canal in it, and a river that ran purple with ill-smelling dye, and vast piles of building full of windows, where there was a rattling and a trembling all day long, and where the piston of the steam engine worked monotonously, up and down, like the head of an elephant in a state of melancholy madness. It contained several large streets, all very like one another, and many small streets, still more like one another, inhabited by people equally like one another, who all went in and out at the same hours, with the same sound, upon the same pavements, to do the same work, and to whom every day was the same as yesterday and tomorrow, and every year the counterpart of the last and the next.
Charles Dickens, Hard Times. We hear there a natural red and black, black smoke, purple rivers, pollution. You hear there, Michael Watts, public goods, externalities, the Coase theorem. Give us the economic rundown.
Well, pollution is the classic example of a spillover or external cost, where some of the cost of producing and consuming a product are shifted over to people who aren't producers and consumers. And so, therefore, you have an overuse of resources like air and water that are publicly, not privately owned. And in that case, there are simply too many people involved to solve the problem through private markets. So pollution is one of the cases of market failures where there's a key role for government to play.
Jack Beattie, that could hardly be more in the headlines right now. I'm sure Charles Dickens didn't exactly set out to influence public policy, but maybe these great authors leave vivid images that do resonate and illustrate economics for everybody.
Yes, and this passage belongs to the tradition of English pastoral protest against industrialism, most famous for Blake's line, "Dark, satanic mills." Mm-hmm. And in the novel, there's actually an economist who's the butt of a very strong satire, Dr. Gradgrind. And Dr. Gradgrind stands before his class and says, "Define a horse," which is, some people think economists have been asking that sort of question for years. On the other side, of course, the other side of the English pastoral is what Karl Marx said about it, the idiocy of rural life, that there's never any advance, that this smoke going up the chimney at least represents increased productivity and increased wealth and possibly opportunity later on.
We're talking tonight with Michael Watts, author of the new book, The Literary Book of Economics. He's latched on to literature as the ultimate illustration palette for economics. And maybe we've all done that naturally, whether we've thought about it or not. What comes first in your mind, the art or the science, the economics of the human condition or its literature? And would you rather study economics with Milton Friedman or Upton Sinclair? We've got a lot more readings and authors to come. Stick with us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. This is On Point. We're looking tonight at economic lessons in the lust and life and passions and epiphanies of classic literature. Our guest joining us tonight from Hanover, Germany, is Michael Watts. He's director of the Center for Economic Education at Purdue University and author of the new book, The Literary Book of Economics. It's the dismal science, but maybe it's around us every time we crack a great book. Do we always know intuitively that we're reading economics, or is it hidden in the texture of life and literature? And does anything transcend economics? We're going to hear a lot of great writing tonight and Michael Watts' economic angle on what lies behind the prose. You can join the conversation as well at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Michael Watts, I wonder what it was that took you to literature in your pursuit of and teaching of economic principles. Was it just too darn hard and dry to sell them straight?
Well, it was just an interest. I was a liberal arts major all the way through. It started out with a double major in economics and philosophy, and after about 7 or 8 courses in philosophy, moved over to literature and drama and got really serious about both fields when I decided to go to grad school.
But you chose economics. Does that mean that you've got something dry as dust at the end of your fingers, or can a full-blooded liberal arts type still really dive all the way into economics?
Oh, well, it's very you have to have the math and the stats, and increasingly more so now than when I did it. But there's a premium, I think, for being able to speak and write well that's still very much there, and the breadth will help you in other ways, too.
And, Jack, we're going to hear a lot more tonight, but it was interesting, as we talked about this show, I felt a certain trepidation on your part in coming into into the full-bodied literature with an economic lens, as though it might scrape away a bunch that really mattered. We're going to hear more, but what do you think about the whole premise, Jack?
Well, you know, I'm a believer, having looked through this anthology. It's just delightful. I think my threshold objection was just the reductivism, of course. The literature is variousness and possibility and not to be reduced to anything. And, of course, in a book on the economics of it, it has to be reduced. And in some cases, it results in a kind of, absurdity, I think.
Well, we'll test that. We'll test both these perspectives. Let's keep diving in. We've got an excerpt here again from Michael Watt's literary book of economics. This is from Kurt Vonnegut, from his Harrison Bergeron short story, where he sets out a futuristic society where, as you'll see, everyone is equal.
The year was 2081, and everybody was finally equal. They weren't only equal before God and the law. They were equal every which way. Nobody was smarter than anybody else. Nobody was better looking than anybody else. Nobody was stronger or quicker than anybody else. All this equality was due to the 211th, 212th, and 213th Amendments to the Constitution and to the unceasing vigilance of the agents of the United States Handicapper General.
And there it is, the beginning of a story that I, for one, would want to go on and read. Michael Watts, it's got an ominous tone to it, everything equal, and in your economist's mind, we are talking about poverty, income distribution, government policies. Take us through the economist lens.
Well, there's a very big difference between equality of opportunity, or at least a reasonable degree of equality of opportunity on the one hand, and policies that treat everybody, make the outcomes exactly equal for everybody, regardless of how different they are in abilities or how hard they work or what their natural talents are, and to some extent even how lucky they are. And Vonnegut just satirizes it very much in line with the way most mainstream economists talk about the need to preserve differences in results and differences in incentives.
Jack, economics never breathes without politics, and here it butts immediately right up against politics.
Yes, this is a sort of satire on a socialist world, or at least on a sort of, a demonological view of a socialist world where people are all the same. Of course, the democratic socialist would say, no, if people have a certain material equality, then their true differences can show, because then they'll be competing with what's in them essentially.
Michael Watts, I wonder, do you find that economists gravitate to the literature that supports their view of the world, that supports the principles they hold most dear? What about a piece of literature that flew in the face of Vonnegut's message here?
Well, I find a lot of them, in fact, are turned off by literature when they read passages that are opposed to a lot of mainstream perspectives on things. And Milton Friedman, for example, in Free to Choose, was talking about the very influential role that some literature had in shaping public attitudes on equality and presenting stereotypes of income inequality, such as The Octopus.
We'll look at that later, but you write about this kind of mutual potential and often realized antagonism between economists and denizens of literature. Is that because if writers may think economists dry, economists think writers dreamy and out of touch with the way things really work sometimes? Is that the point?
Well, what I find and what a bunch of literary historians, or rather new field of literary criticism and history, have found is that there's an incredible range. There is no one literary point of view. I mean, I think that's an important thing that I was trying to demonstrate, that there's a very wide view of political perspective in the literary writings, just as there is among economists.
Jack, we're going to step out of Michael Watts' book for a moment to an excerpt that you've brought to us from Joseph Heller's Something Happened. Set us up, Jack.
Yes, this is an excerpt from a chapter called The Office in Which I Work. It's about an advertising man in New York and the role that fear plays in motivating him in his office.
Let's hear it.
In the office in which I work, there are five people of whom I am afraid. Each of these five people is afraid of four people, for a total of 20. And each of these 20 people is afraid of six people, making a total of 120 people who are feared by at least one person. Each of these 120 people is afraid of the other 119, and all of the 145 people are afraid of the 12 men at the top who helped found and build the company and now own and direct it. In my department, there are six people who are afraid of me and one small secretary who is afraid of all of us. I have one other person working for me who is not afraid of anyone, not even me, and I would fire him quickly. But I'm afraid of him.
So, Jack, you've taken us right outside the 78 examples that Michael Watts has put together. So this hits Michael Watts cold, and I'm curious to see how you and he interpret it. Jack, we've got emotion and motivation here.
Yes. I mean, there are theories about, you know, what is it that motivates employees? And at the final level, of course, it's starvation, isn't it? If we don't work, we won't eat. And fear, therefore, is a crucial component of the economic life.
Is that too soft an interpretation for you, Michael Watts? What's your economist view on this one?
Well, I'm not sure that fear is a more basic motivator than greed, say, but I think both certainly play a role, positive and negative incentives, and economists have models of things like efficiency wages, where workers may be in a job where they're paid a little more than they can earn anyplace else, and because of that, they have more at risk in losing the job, so they work harder and are more productive, and employers don't have to monitor their effort quite as much.
Now, that seems like a real literary question, whether fear or greed is the stronger motivator. It's been explored in many works of literature. Do economists sit around weighing that sort of thing? Do they try and turn it into a statistical model?
They try to put a number on how important different kinds of incentives are. For example, what's the effect of if we reduce the tax on labor, how much more will people work?
And right there, you've got government policy. Sometimes government policy comes into less subtle circumstances. You've got Upton Sinclair's The Jungle in the book excerpted, and we're going to hear a little bit of that right now.
Jonas had told them how the meat that was taken out of pickle would often be found sour, and how they would rub it up with soda to take away the smell and sell it to be eaten on free lunch counters. Also, of all the miracles of chemistry which they performed, giving to any sort of meat, fresh or salted, whole or chopped, any color and any flavor and any odor they chose. In the pickling of hams, they had an ingenious apparatus by which they saved time and increased the capacity of the plant, a machine consisting of a hollow needle attached to a pump. By plunging this needle into the meat and working with his foot, a man could fill a ham with pickle in a few seconds. And yet, in spite of this, there would be hams found spoiled, some of them with an odor so bad that a man could hardly bear to be in the room with them. To pump into these, the packers had a second and much stronger pickle which destroyed the odor, a process known to the workers as giving them 30%.
Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, famously revolting, and it doesn't send me scurrying for a ham sandwich, Michael Watts, but as an economist, how do you read it?
Well, if people can figure out what's been prepared badly, they'll stay away from it on their own. But the old saying is that you never want to know how sausages are made, and in this case, hams either. President Theodore Roosevelt set a commission to work to explore the meat industry after The Jungle came out to see if things were as bad as Sinclair said they were. And the report came back and said that they were indeed. And so we ended up with an agency called the Food and Drug Administration.
So to an economist, though, does it really matter as long as people will buy the gussied up stinking ham? does anything else really rate here?
Well, the question about how much regulation is efficient is one that's perpetually researched and studied by economists, and we find cases where the regulation pays for itself and is a good thing, and other cases where there's over-regulation and too much. The FDA is a good one. Safety requirements with the FDA are fairly well received by most economists who've looked at them, but a more recent piece of their charge that they test the efficacy of drugs has come under much more challenge.
Jack, I'm struck at how it seems the world needs a succession of Upton Sinclair, though, to keep these issues alive and in the public eye and to keep government really paying attention. Otherwise, well, off it all rolls.
Yes, and then we have Fast Food Nation by Eric Schlosser, which talks about some of the odoriferous practices still going on in the meat industry and also the exploitation of the workforce. You know, the idea that people, that Americans are overregulated on the job, we need to keep in mind one sort of salient fact. It was not until 1996 that there was a federal right to void, that is, urinate on the job. That's something to keep in mind when you hear that people are overregulated.
Well, you would hope that you didn't need a federal right, but maybe you do, and Upton Sinclair would be pointing it out if we did. We're talking tonight about the economics of literature, the dismal science that rules our lives through the palette of Dickens and Vonnegut and Frost and more, as you'll hear. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Does anything in literature or elsewhere transcend economics? 1-800-423-8255. Talk. George is calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, George. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I thought it was interesting. I teach a course in law and literature, and the basic justification and theory of the course is very similar to what the professor does with economics.
Namely, because literature is more effective than the law itself in telling the story?
No, not exactly. Rather than teach legal philosophy through books of legal philosophy, one can do it almost as well with works of literature. The one question I have, the difficulty I have, I tend to do the same thing. That is, I take certain selections or whole texts, discrete texts, and try to bind them together in a course. But the one difficulty, there may be others as well, and I was wondering what the professor thought about this, or if he had given any thought to it, which is, how do you pull all this together into some kind of an overall theoretical framework and structure, which you would get if you were reading Milton Friedman or some other economic theorist?
If you read,
you may not get by just reading separate literary texts.
Yeah, if you read the whole bookshelf, do you come out with a unified theory? Michael Watts, how about it? Do you intend this to leave people with a full sense of economics, or is this a grab bag for professors and students and citizens to dive into?
A little bit in the middle. It's not as organized as a full-blown course in economics, but if you look at the table of contents, it's fairly, which is broken up by a group of 20-some various concepts. It's you can teach a course out of it, and I have taught a course out of these readings that will parallel a lot of the content of a basic introductory economics course.
Labor markets, unions, human capital, discrimination, immigration, substitution, income effect, it's all here. I guess it's up to the reader whether it adds up to a full view of economics or not. I want to get more literature in here. George, thanks for your call. Here's an excerpt from another piece that you've picked up, Michael Watts, from actually David Sedaris, from Something for Everyone, an autobiographical essay trying to figure out how to get by without working too hard.
The day after graduating from college, I found $50 in the foyer of my Chicago apartment building. The single bill had been folded into eighths and was packed with cocaine. It occurred to me then that if I played my cards right, I might never have to find a job. People lost things all the time. They left class rings on the sinks of public bathrooms and dropped gem-studded earrings at the doors of the opera house. My job was to keep my eyes open and find these things. I didn't want to become one of those coots who combed the beaches of Lake Michigan with a metal detector, but if I paid attention and used my head, I might never have to work again. The following afternoon, hungover from cocaine, I found 12 cents and an unopened tin of breath mints. Figuring in my previous $50, that amounted to an average of $25.06 per day, which was still a decent wage. The next morning, I discovered 2 pennies and a comb matted with short, curly hairs. The day after that, I found a peanut. It was then that I started to worry.
All right, Michael Watts, economist. Many NPR listeners will know David Sedaris, but I'm not sure that we've sat around interpreting him from an economic angle. Pick up on the lessons in this bit.
Well, I try to juxtapose this against a passage from the autobiography of Ben Franklin and the little list at the end of The Great Gatsby that describes Gatsby as a youth spending a lot of time trying to train himself and improve himself and invest in what economists call human capital. And Sedaris's hilarious little story is almost the anti-list of how not to get ahead or, by investing in human capital, but how to disinvest. And he admits later in the passage he really didn't understand the education that he was getting, that he went to art school, and they were willing to take him as long as he paid tuition, whether he had any talent or not. It's a little bit like David Mamet's American Buffalo, where you've got a group of people who just don't understand late markets and just can't compete, frankly.
So is it a cultural moment that you're reading there or an economic moment, or do they overlap? Does it give you fear for the economy as an economist? Is it a marker of a change in society, or when you compare Ben Franklin and David Sedaris?
Oh, no, I don't think so. I think you could find characters like Sedaris earlier in earlier passages and from earlier centuries.
So you're not dropping your projections of growth in GDP as a result of reading Sedaris?
No, not based on that.
Well, you're a good and tolerant economist. We're looking tonight at economic lessons in the lust and life and passions and epiphanies of classic literature with Michael Watts. He's author of The Literary Book of Economics. You can join us. What's a literary moment that blazes with economics for you? And what's a literary moment that goes beyond economics? Did your summer beach book illuminate supply and demand, opportunity cost, cost-benefit trade-offs? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Support for this is On Point. We're talking tonight about economic lessons in classic literature. We're joined by Michael Watts. He's author of the new book, The Literary Book of Economics. He's director of the Center for Economic Education at Purdue University and professor of economics there. You can join the conversation tonight. Does anything transcend economics? Does literature? Does economics look different to you through a literary lens? It's fun, and we're having it, and we're learning in the process. Hey, it's still summer. We're hanging on to that. Jack, I knew I could trust you to bring some Steinbeck in here, and you have. And it's on property rights, as it would be. Let's hear it, Grapes of Wrath.
This is a passage from the Grapes of Wrath, and it's about the Dust Bowl. Of course, farmers had to typically borrow against their farms to plant next year's crop. The Dust Bowl in the 30s essentially made that wipe that out, and there were repossessions all over, especially in the state of Oklahoma. And the migration of the Okies from Oklahoma to California is the subject of the Grapes of Wrath. And here come the owners. Mm. The owners of the land came onto the land. Or more often, a spokesman for the owners came. They came in clothes cars, and they felt the dry earth with their fingers. And sometimes they drove big earth augers into the ground for soil tests. The tenants, from their sun-beaten dooryards, watched uneasily when the clothes cars drove along the fields. Some of the owner men were kind because they hated what they had to do, and some of them were angry because they hated to be cruel, and some of them were cold because they had long ago found that one could not be an owner unless one were cold. And all of them were caught in something larger than themselves. Some of them hated the mathematics that drove them, and some were afraid, and some worshiped the mathematics because it provided a refuge from thought and from feeling. If a bank or a finance company owned the land, the owner man said, the bank or the company needs, wants, insists, must have, as though the bank or the company were a monster with thought and feeling, which had ensnared them.
Mm. Michael Watts, is this economic or is this anti-economic?
it's a good depiction of an amazing transformation that took place in this country, where in 1920 we still had roughly 40% of our labor force in agriculture, and today it's down to about 3%. And my father went broke in Kansas trying to be a wheat farmer in the early 1950s. So I have, a considerable amount of empathy for the pain that's involved. But and the Dust Bowl, the conditions of the 30s certainly accelerated and made all of that a much broader and deeper problem than it had ever been before.
Mm. But it's really more than describing a change in occupation, even a migration from from farm to city. Isn't there here, and I wonder if you don't see broad swaths of this, literature in a way struggling against the demands, the realities of economics, as though in a way economics is another word for the human condition, which is sometimes just so damnably difficult?
Well, there's a tradition on the one hand, and I think that Jack talked about this earlier. It's part of the human condition to want to hang on to tradition and do what we've done and not have to change. It's also part of our nature to change over time and respond and even start inventions and companies that do what Schumpeter called the process of creative destruction and tear up our old ways and do all of this. Both of these things are a big part of what economics goes through, and we see it today with many economists saying, okay, we can have more support for free trade agreements if we will adopt social policies that help in the relocation and retraining of workers who may be displaced by that.
Jack, how do you see it? Literature as an effort to come to terms with economics or to try and endlessly look for the path that transcends economics?
Well, I think it is economics. I mean, it's an illustration of one of the darkest dicta about the economic world, and that from one of the greatest of all economists, Karl Marx. He wrote, "The capitalist is capital personified." And if you think about that and its implications for the moral life of man, that's troubling. And it happens all the time. People act as if they are money, not as if they are people, because the system compels them to act that way.
Well, the system, or is that, the economist might say this is just the reality of the species we belong to, the world we live in, back to that phrase, the human condition, Jack.
Well, capitalism is a historical formation. It arose in time, and it's not the nature of man. It came out of history, and it will stay in history. It's not human nature.
Michael Watts, economist, your view?
Well, whether human nature is eternal or changing over time is something that occasionally gets debated by economists, more often by philosophers and broader social thinkers. But I really think that there are more aspects to human nature and the ordinary business of life and these that are exacerbated by these periods of extreme upheaval. Brecht once said, the happy times for the ordinary guy are when there aren't dramatic things going on, but for the historians, they like to look at the times when there are these momentous changes.
And maybe you're illuminating there the writer or literature as the bridge between economics and philosophy. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Does anything transcend economics, even literature? David's calling from Bel Air, Michigan. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. How you doing?
Great, thanks.
I had a couple of... It's fascinating to listen to this conversation because it just brings up so many more thoughts in my head. But I wanted to make a couple of observations. Number one, when it comes to authors, including, I guess, things that can be interpreted in their literature mm-hmm. as economics, most people, I mean, when I was 5 years old, I was debating the value of a nickel and what it would get me and what I really wanted to spend it on.
Yeah.
I think that people start from the ground up, even if they don't have money, there's always a cost-benefit analysis that most people make. It becomes a part of their nature. And if any author is going to write any kind of book, say it's a Dickens book or Kurt Vonnegut or, Clockwork Orange or anything else, somewhere they have to include the economics of daily life because it is daily life.
So it's as fundamental to literature, in your view, as it is to economics, that principle.
Well, sure. I mean, I don't see how you could get away from it because it's a part of living. And it doesn't have to be money. I mean, the bushman in Africa has to make a cost-benefit analysis about what he's going to expend for energy in order to get the food he needs to survive.
And you had a thought on regulation as well, David.
Well, the regulation part was very simple. I can't conceive of anything at this point in man's moral advancement where unregulated capitalism would be anything but destructive. There was a gentleman named, it's either Metternich or Tacitus, I can't remember which, who came up with the quote that laws are most numerous when society is most corrupt. And that's where regulation comes from. If if mankind as a whole, this moral beast that we like to think we are, actually thought and acted in a moral capacity, we wouldn't need regulation. We do that because most people can't be trusted. And if somebody doesn't watch them, they're going to constantly pull a fast one, because the bottom line with capitalism is he who dies with the most toys wins.
Well, along the way, the economists tell us it also produces a lot of toys. David, wonderful to hear from you, and thanks for your call. Connor's calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Connor. You're on the air.
Hello. How are you?
Great, thanks.
Thanks for the program. Great program. I think, you know, the Great Depression was the dysfunction of economics, of modern economics. And I think Steinbeck gave a human face to that in his book, The Grapes of Wrath. But I think, you know, economics is about improving the human condition. And the advent of John Maynard Keynes and government intervention for expanding the economy when the economy is in contraction brought about a more enlightened time for us. You know, recessions now are much milder than they used to be in the Great Depression.
So are you saying that literature sort of opened everyone's eyes to need that led to advancement in economic thinking?
Well, I think at its best, economics is about improving the human condition.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that what Steinbeck wrote about in The Grapes of Wrath was the great human toll that came about from applying this mathematical model of economics that had served reasonably well up to that point in time. And it gave rise to the innovation of John Maynard Keynes saying, all we have to do is for a large actor like the government to show that we have faith in the future, and then everybody will, this problem will be self-correcting.
We can do something different, we can do something better, but something that, as you describe it, takes almost the equivalent of a literary vision to actually pull it off. Connor, thanks very much for calling. Jack, Michael, our time is running down. I want to push ahead just a little bit here. Jack, you've got Jonathan Swift's A Modest Proposal there. And, of course, here's a real archetype of satire, but there's also plenty of economics here. Give us a bit.
Well, this is, of course, a parable about England's exploitation of Ireland, and the cannibalism that solves Ireland's problem is really a metaphor for that exploitation. I have been assured by a very knowing American of my acquaintance in London that a young, healthy child, well-nursed, is at a year old a most delicious, nourishing, and wholesome food, whether stewed, roasted, baked, or boiled, and I make no doubt that it will equally serve in a fricassee or ragout. I grant this food will be somewhat dear, and therefore very proper for landlords who, as they have already devoured most of the parents, seem to have the best title to the children. I have already computed the charge of nursing a beggar's child, in which list I reckon all cottagers, laborers, and 4/5 of the farmers, to be about 2 shillings per annum, rags included, and I believe no gentleman would repine to give 10 shillings for the carcass of a good fat child.
Oh, jeez. The child for lunch. Michael Watts, you've got this in your book under cost-benefit analysis, but how do you bring that in when satire is fully at play?
Well, clearly it's a satire, but clearly it's a satire of rational cost-benefit analysis applied where there is not any overarching social framework that says there are certain basic human rights that transcend the market, that are above the market. That Arthur Oaken had a famous book called Equality and Efficiency, where he said, look, we can have markets for slavery, we can have markets for buying and selling votes on the day of the election that will make buyers and sellers both happier and better off, just the way markets say. But for good reasons that transcend economics, there are some things that are more important than markets and economics, that are more fundamental. And so we have to have the government say, or some group say, or just as a matter of personal conscience say, we're not going to allow slavery, we're not going to allow markets for infants to be sold as food and so forth.
And we almost had a market for terror risk. I want to get one more reading in here. Alexander Pope, Imitations of Horace, a poem about a soldier relevant to our time. Pope shows how as income and wealth rise, so does the demand for safety.
In Anna's Wars, a soldier, poor and old, had dearly earned a little purse of gold. Tired with a tedious march one luckless night, he slept, poor dog, and lost it to a doit. This put the man in such a desperate mind, between revenge and grief and hunger joined. against the foe, himself and all mankind, he leapt the trenches, scaled a castle wall, tore down a standard, took down the fort and all. Prodigious well, his great commander cried, gave him much praise and some reward beside. Next pleased his excellence a town to batter, its name I know not, and it's no great matter. Go on, my friend, he cried, see yonder walls, advance and conquer, go where glory calls. More honors, more rewards attend the brave. Don't you remember what reply he gave? Do you think me, noble general, such a sot? Let him take castles who has ne'er a groat.
He had a bag of gold, and he wasn't quite as eager to go to war. Michael Watts, our time is very short, but your quick economic take from that.
Just the quick point that the content of the poem is exactly the same as what was in the original by Horace, and so it does say something about how persistent and eternal these incentives are. But when you have nothing to lose, you'll take more risks, and when you do have something to lose, you're going to be a little more cautious and demand more safety.
Michael Watts, we thank you for all your insights and, as much as anything, for getting us to shake out our bookshelf here and bring all this literature into the light of day and of economics. Thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me very much.
Michael Watts is a professor of economics at Purdue University and author of the new book with 78 such examples, The Literary Book of Economics. Jack Beattie, final thought.
Well, we don't want to forget how literary the great economists are. Adam Smith, A Sentence on the Division of Labor. The understandings of the greater part of men are necessarily formed by their ordinary employments. The man whose whole life is spent in performing a few simple operations has no occasion to exert his understanding. He generally becomes as stupid and ignorant as it is possible for a human creature to become.
The economist in literary flight. Jack, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Special thanks to our readers tonight, Meghna Chakrabarty, Anna Benstead, Fred Tice, Sean Cole, and Virginia Prescott. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for this program.